Big brown bats and little brown bats are the most common, but Iowa's home to 9 different species of bats. Unfortunately, bats everywhere are at risk. White nose syndrome has killed millions of bats in the U.S. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the bats of Iowa. We'll talk about the different species that live in our state, efforts to research and monitor bat populations, and the important role they play in our ecosystem. We'll also talk about human-bat interactions and, of course, white nose syndrome. I'll talk with Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Adam Jenke, Russ Benedict, biology professor at Central College, and Kelly Poole of the Department of Natural Resources. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Bats are a fascinating and beneficial part of our ecosystem, but they have a public relations problem. Centuries of fictional villainy and bad publicity means that many people are still frightened and disgusted by them. In addition to their undeserved bad reputation, bats are also at risk because of environmental pressures, loss of habitat, and worst of all, a mysterious syndrome called white nose syndrome that has killed over 6 million bats in the United States alone. This hour, we're going to find out about the bats of Iowa. We'll talk about the species that live here, the role they play, and the challenges they face. My first guest today is Kelly Poole, threatened and endangered species coordinator at the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And first of all, Kelly, I think a lot of people don't encounter bats in their day-to-day life. How many different species of bats do we have living in Iowa?
We have 9 species of bats that live in the state. The most common ones are probably the big brown bat and the little brown bat are the 2 species that the public may encounter more. Those are ones that we will see in neighborhoods, in parks, more commonly.
All right. So when you look up at night and you see the bats fluttering around, that's probably what you're seeing, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So with the other species in Iowa, the big brown bat and the little brown bat are fairly common. What is the status of the other species?
Well, we assume that up until white nose came to the state that they were pretty stable. We've got 1 species of bat that is listed in the state as endangered. That's the Indiana bat. It's also a federally listed species. Northern long-eared bats have recently been listed as threatened with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and that's currently under review, the status of that species in the state. But other than that, we're really at a place where we're starting to look at monitoring data that we have, baseline information, and like I said, with white nose syndrome on the horizon for the state, trying to understand where we are.
Well,
at present.
Yeah, let's talk about the data that we do have. I mean, how do you monitor bat populations?
Bats can be monitored in a couple different ways. The most, I guess, certain way would be mist netting. It's where biologists will go to areas where bats, habitat for bats, like forested areas, and they set up very fine nests or nets and will capture bats, be able to identify them in that way. The other way that we monitor bats in the state is acoustic monitoring, where we have detectors that are specialized in recording the frequency of bat echolocation calls. And so scientists who study these data are able to get a sense of what species of bats we have or groups of species that we have based on the call frequency. And they can also get a general sense of bat activity in an area. We can't get population estimates from acoustic data, but we can say something about bat activity and the number of species that we may have.
All right, so you can tell the species apart based on what you hear, what the recordings that you make?
Right. Experts can.
All right. And how is that sound collected?
So it's a recording device. It's a detector that is specialized, like I said, to record at the frequency that the bats emit when they are echolocating. We know that bats will echolocate. They essentially, it's like a biological type of sonar. They send signals out and it bounces off of objects, you know, in the vicinity of the bat, and it comes back, and the bat's able to sort of navigate and locate food and stuff in that process. And so these recording devices will capture that information and then through a series of filters kind of distill it down into frequencies that scientists who study bats can actually give us meaningful interpretations of.
All right. So are people actually just driving around with these microphones basically on top of their cars recording sounds, hoping to hear bats?
That's a really great question. So we do, we have a couple different programs or ways to do that. So we have some stationary sites. That's where a detector is set out in, again, a forested area, in an area where you would expect to find bats. And it's just placed out there for a couple nights, and all of the sounds are recorded. It trips on, you know, with a timer. It will come on at dusk, and it goes off, you know, stays on overnight. So those are stationary detectors that are placed to capture information, like, in the woods at night. Then we also have volunteer wildlife monitors who collect information on driving routes, like you hinted at there. So a microphone is plopped onto the top of the car, and the volunteers will drive this established route. Again, it's going through an area of habitat where we would expect to find bats, and they're recording those sounds. And then a third program that we have in terms of monitoring bats is through the Wildlife Diversity Program. Again, the Multi-Species Inventory and Monitoring Program, they have walking transects. So they're walking through our public lands, taking recordings for a period of time to understand what we have on public lands.
The caves at Maquoketa Caves State Park, I know that's a place where a lot of bats congregate. It's also a place where some steps have been taken to protect those bat colonies. Can you tell me about what's been going on in Maquoketa?
Well, it's not just Maquoketa. It's any of the caves that are on public lands. We do observe and have for some time winter closures. So the caves are closed for a period of time over the winter when bats would be present and hibernating, just to give the bats an opportunity to hibernate undisturbed. The rest of the year, the caves have been open. We do have educational programs that the public is asked to participate in so that they have an understanding of what white-nose syndrome is, the appropriate decontamination protocols, steps that should be taken after they visit a cave, and then they are permitted and allowed to go in.
Now, a couple of years ago, in 2015, there were three bats collected in Des Moines County in Iowa that were confirmed to have white nose syndrome. Very scary development for the bats of Iowa. What is the status of white nose syndrome in the state?
So as you know, Charity, we have confirmed white nose syndrome in the state. And we're really, at this point, in an active surveillance or monitoring mode. You know, we will continue to check on our hibernating colonies in the wintertime. These acoustic data that have been collected through the volunteer wildlife monitoring program and through the multi-species inventory and monitoring program, those data will continue to be collected. We'll be able to look at that data prior to when we had white nose syndrome detected in the state and then after that. So we will be looking at those data, you know, like a year to 2 years to 3 years out to see if we see any changes or can detect or perceive any differences in maybe species assemblages or bat activity.
So we're still in an exploration phase.
Absolutely, right. The pattern as white nose syndrome has come from the East has been you get confirmation of the disease within your state, and it can be some time before you actually see changes in the population.
But if those changes come, it can be devastating. I mean, there have been entire colonies just wiped out, right?
Right, absolutely, right. So, you know, the colonies that we're aware of on public land, you know, are a couple hundred, you know, up to maybe like 600 bats. We don't have a big hibernating colonies like, say, exist like in Missouri or in southern Illinois or other, you know, areas of the country. We just don't have a lot of that. There may be some on private land that we don't know of because it is private land, but we have no way of knowing what those numbers are. We're really wanting to understand how, you know, those summer populations can be affected by this disease, because, you know, we have 9 species of bats that do occur in Iowa, and half of those, I guess 4 species, have been documented as hibernating in the caves, you know, in the state, but other bats migrate and leave the state, and so, you know, some of our summer populations are winter residents elsewhere. So we'll be looking at, like, if those numbers change. And with regard to, you know, the ecological services that bats provide, you know, the importance that they play in the ecosystem and the importance on our human economies, like agricultural crops, you know, it's those summer bats and loss of those bats on the landscape, eating insects, playing that important role, like, in our ecosystems that we are concerned about.
Is there anything that you feel can be done right now to protect those bats, other than the winter cave closures? But these are not the bats that we're talking about. We're talking about the bats that come and go and don't spend the winters here. There's been a lot of research about white nose syndrome, but there's not a solution yet, right?
Right. There's not a solution yet. You know, in the Fish and Wildlife Service and a lot of state agencies, as well as academic institutions across the country and across the world, are really trying to understand, you know, how this is killing bat colonies and what we can do to stop it and what we can do to protect it. You know, right now what the public can do, again, is to, you know, respect those that hibernation period and not disturb hibernating bats. And then I think forest habitat is important. You know, I think that landowners that do have forests, you know, making sure that we're protecting that summer habitat to the degree that we can, to have a healthy environment for bats to come back to and to raise young and to continue.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for talking with me.
You bet. Thank you, Charity. I appreciate the opportunity.
Kelly Poole of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. This hour, we're talking about the bats of Iowa. We will continue our conversation in a moment, find out more about the different bat species that live in our state, the challenges they're facing, and why we should care. Adam Janke, ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist, is going to join us in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the bats of Iowa. We'll talk about the different species that live here, what we know about them, what we're trying to find out, and the challenges facing these creatures as well. With me right now, Adam Janke. He is an assistant professor at Iowa State University and the ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist. Hello, Adam.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
And I was talking with Kelly Poole about the number of different species of bats that live in the state of Iowa. And there are up to 9, but there are a few core species that really are kind of the bats that we are more likely to see in Iowa. So let's talk about the ones that we see most often. First, let's talk about the big brown bat and the little brown bat. Tell me a little bit about them.
Yeah, so you're right that the little brown bat and the big brown bat are both in the same genus called Myotis, and they're familiar species. They're certainly the ones we see flying around in our backyards most of the time, and they are in the category of bats in Iowa that hibernate here, and they're also in the category of bats here in Iowa that feed in open spaces and relate to forested areas and trees during the summertime. Telling the difference between bats in the air is a pretty challenging thing. So we kind of just have to go off of numbers that we see in the state. And that's why we know big brown bats and little brown bats are the most abundant in our backyards.
All right. And so when you see a bat, you think that's a bat.
Right.
not necessarily exactly what kind of bat it is. And I think that the name big brown bat is a little bit of a misnomer because these are not very big creatures.
Yeah, none of our bats in Iowa are very big creatures like we see sometimes in the movies with things like fruit bats that really are pretty remarkably large. Big brown bats in Iowa weigh between 11 and 17 grams. That's about the size of a goldfinch, really. It's not much larger than our state bird that we're all familiar with. So, and then the sizes actually go down from there. I think our smallest bat in Iowa is the tricolored bat. Some people call those eastern pipistrelles as well. And those are go down to 3.5 grams in weight. So these are pretty small creatures, and they're all, like I said, about the same size.
All right. And you mentioned the big brown bat and the little brown bat, the tricolor bat, that also falls into the same category, these hibernating bats. So these are the bats that stay here year round?
Yeah, they stay in Iowa or really close year round. We do see a little bit of movement from what we call hibernacula, and that's where the hibernating bats spend their winters. We see a little bit of movement from areas generally in eastern and southern Iowa, where we have the places that they could hibernate, out to the rest of the state, where there's not places that they could hibernate, but there are places where they can raise their young. But those movements are really short. They're just, for example, from northeastern Missouri to northwestern Iowa, no further.
All right. And the other bat species that fall into that hibernating bat category, also the Indiana bat and the northern long-eared. And we're going to talk a lot more about the northern long-eared bat in just a moment. But when we think about hibernacula, if we think about hibernacula, I think a lot of us do think about caves. That's sort of the stereotypical idea of where bats live. And they really do live in caves, right?
Oh, yeah, they certainly do. All these hibernating bats that we're talking about will relate to caves. And there's good reason for that. A cave, the further down into the ground you go, the more stable the temperatures are going to be. And imagine an animal that's as small as a bat, as we're talking about, having to survive our winter temperatures. They, of course, can't be any place where they're exposed to those extreme temperature swings. So we see them go pretty far back into caves a lot of times to find where the temperature will be basically the exact same from early November when they go in until March when they exit.
Are caves the only places where they can hibernate for the winter?
Nope. We'll find them. Some bats are a little more flexible in natural areas, and they'll even hibernate in crevices and things like that. We also see them using artificial things that they mistake for a cave, essentially. So mine entrances are really common. We've opened up these seams into the earth, essentially, and bats have found those to be to fit the bill, essentially, for what they're looking for in a hibernation spot. And then one that I suspect people are waiting for me to acknowledge is the attic. And that's certainly something we see, particularly with big brown bats. Big brown bats prefer a relatively warmer hibernation place, and all of that energy that you're using to heat your home, of course, is going into the attic. And bats, if they can find their way in, have made pretty good use, or big brown bats have made pretty good use of human habitations for their own hibernacula during the wintertime, for better or worse.
Now, do bats sometimes stick around those cave areas during the summer as well?
Oh, yeah, they certainly do. It's sort of a mix of both things. They'll stick right around where their winter hibernacula are, or they'll take off and spread out across the landscape when it's warmer. And then also, of course, they just have fewer constraints on the type of places that they can live during the summertime.
Well, I feel really lucky because in my parents' barn, they've had a summer colony of big brown bats for many years. So they disappear in the winter, they come back in the summer, and they live primarily in between two pieces of wood that are part of the rafter system of the barn. So there's this kind of a narrow space in between these two rafters that's about, 4 to 6 inches wide, and it's just jam-packed with bats. That seems like a really strange place to live, but that's the kind of thing they're looking for, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's really an interesting observation. They, some of our bats are what form summer colonies where they raise their young and of course all feed together. And that's certainly what you're seeing there is those bats perceive that barn structure to be good enough, kind of like we see with the mines. They think a mine is just fine working for a cave. A barn is just fine working for what maybe a dead tree would provide during the summertime in a natural area, or a loose bark tree, something like shagbark hickories and American elms and white oaks, where they provide spaces where the bats can fold up underneath. They can be protected from the weather and then quickly go out and feed around those roosting areas during the nighttime.
Now, of course, bats are mammals, so that means that they have live birth and they nurse their babies. And in these colonies, they also have nursing colonies. So when they go out to feed, they leave the babies behind. Tell me how that works.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. They form these nursery colonies, and then mom obviously has to feed and have a nutritious diet to be able to produce the milk that she's using to raise the small young before they're able to feed on their own. And so they huddle their young into groups in the maternity colonies, as we call them. Mom goes out and feeds and comes back and nurses the young until they're able to emerge. We call that volency, when they're able to fly. And then once those young emerge, they start to learn, just like all the other more conspicuous baby wildlife do, I'm sure, through fits and starts of learning how to fly and learning how to use echolocation to catch their young or catch their prey.
Right. That seems like a very complicated thing for a baby bat to learn
sure
how
does.
To do.
Yeah.
So we think about, there is that saying, blind as a bat. Yeah. We know that bats use echolocation. So they use that sound, the sonar, to navigate and to find their prey. What is their eyesight actually like?
Yeah, that's a common misconception. Bats are not blind, but they aren't necessarily as adapted for nocturnal vision as some of the common things that we think about, the things that have reflective eyes like deer and coyotes and things like that. And so bats forage in the air. They're looking for insects during the nighttime. And so what they're doing is using echolocation. And as they emit certain frequencies, that returns back to them. They're able to detect it through highly evolved structures in their ears, and then they are able to key in on flying insects, and that's how they capture them. It's a pretty remarkable foraging behavior that they've evolved. But then, of course, they do also see. They use sight to find places for roost. They use sight for reproduction. They use sight for finding their hibernation places as well.
When the mother bats return to that nursery colony, there can be thousands and thousands of baby bats in this colony. What do we know about how the baby and the mother find each other when they come back?
Oh, that's an interesting question. And I actually don't know the answer to that.
Bats have a lot of secrets.
And a better bat biologist may know the answer to that. I don't know that off the top of my head. It's certainly an interesting question.
All right. Well, I want to, before we bring another bat biologist into the conversation, I want to also hit on some of the migratory species, because, the hibernating species, those are the ones that I think maybe we're more familiar with, but we have some of the coolest bats come and visit our estate. So tell me about these migratory species.
So we have four migratory species that we can sort of reliably find in Iowa. That's the silver-haired bat, the hoary bat, which is our biggest bat, red bat and evening bat. And these things have, in some cases, really wide distributions. The hoary bats go all the way up into Canada, and then they winter down in the southern United States and into Central America. And they So that's an alternative to the hibernation strategy that we see in the bats we were talking about, the more familiar Big Brown and Little Brown and the others. But so they will arrive in Iowa around April. Some of course are migrating through, just like we see migratory birds. They just forage in Iowa for a few nights and then they keep going on to the north, and then many of them migrate back here to raise their young. These migrating bats are almost always associated just with trees, so we call them tree bats. So they relate to raise their young in trees. They roost in trees during the night, and then of course all bats forage around trees during the nighttime.
Are the migratory bats more individual, less colonial?
They tend to be more individual. There's some exceptions to that, and some of these migratory bats even do form big colonies during the wintertime, not in Iowa because it's too cold, but in the south. But yes, they tend to be more individual, and that even varies. Even some of the hibernators are more solitary than others.
Now, I want to talk about the red bat, and I don't know as much about the hoary or the silver-haired bat, but the red bat, I admire a lot of different mothers in nature, but red bat mothers have my undying admiration because they not only give birth, they often have a litter of little bat, I don't know, are they pups? Are they
yep,
kids?
Pup, okay, pups. Yep.
And they carry them with them as they fly.
Yeah, red bats are certainly an interesting species. They're also quite unique. You can find red bats. If you Google a picture of red bats, they look more like a teddy bear than anything, I think.
A very tiny teddy bear.
A very tiny teddy bear. And they're one of our migrants that arrives here in April, and it is gone by October. This is one that spends all their time in the forest, like we talked with most of these tree bats, and probably don't see around our human dwellings very often, but is certainly an interesting species to find in the wild.
Absolutely. Well, I want to bring someone else into the conversation now. I'm talking with Adam Jenke. He is the Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. And now joining us is Russ Benedict. He's a professor of biology at Central College in Pella. He's focusing his research on the northern long-eared bat. Hello, Russ.
Well, good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Great. Thank you so much for being here.
You bet. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. And tell me more. We haven't talked much about the northern long-eared bat. Tell me about this species.
Well, northern long-eared are a pretty poorly known bat. They're another one of those little guys. They weigh in at about the weight of a penny or so. They're pretty strictly forest bats. They're pretty cool in that, you know, all of our Iowa bats are insect eaters, but northern long-eared will actually add in some spiders. They're incredibly maneuverable. They can hover. They're actually one of the slower flying of our local bats. And so they'll fly in and among the forest canopy. They'll pick off insects, probably grab some caterpillars off of leaves, but also will hover in front of a spider's web and pull the spider out of there. But they're one that is seriously declining because of white-nose fungus. And so they have recently been listed as a federally threatened species. And whatever critters are added to either the endangered list or the threatened list, that normally frees up a little bit of money, and also makes kind of raises people's interest level. And so here in the last couple of years, a lot of research has actually focused in on northern long-eared.
What do we know about their populations in Iowa so far? I mean, bats are pretty hard to find, pretty hard to track and to do a good survey of.
Right. No doubt about it. There's essentially two ways you can survey them. You can do kind of the older-fashioned technology like I do, which is where you go out and string up mist nets in the woods, looking for kind of logical flight corridors through the woods, and then basically cross your fingers because it's really unpredictable. You set up a bunch of nets, and they all look good to you, but only one or two of those nets is actually going to catch bats. But so we have been doing mist net work I've been doing it for about 15 years in Iowa, and so we can kind of compare those numbers. But the other thing you can do then is to use acoustic monitoring. So there's a variety of different tools you can use from different manufacturers that record the bats. And then you can play that into a computer. And then by measuring certain aspects of the calls, you can identify, in some cases, right down to which species you're listening to. So fairly recently, in about the last 5 years or so, we've begun putting up these these monitoring stations across the state that that record on a regular basis. We can then start to estimate population numbers from those as well. And what I have seen with my NIST netting is that so far Iowa's bats don't seem to be declining. I don't see a noticeable drop in the number of bats I catch per net. And another sign that white nose is kind of really ravaging the bats in your area is bats that have had the fungus but survived will get these big visible scars on their wings. And we're literally not seeing that yet in Iowa. I think it could be, essentially any day now, because many of the states, especially to our north and to our east, are seeing pretty significant population declines, including the states right next to Iowa. So I think it's quite possible we will see declines, but I haven't seen them yet.
And, of course, white nose syndrome works very fast. So even if you haven't seen declines yet, I mean, the decline could happen seemingly in a matter of weeks, couldn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It attacks the bats as they're hibernating, certainly hitting these big caves. Some of the bats in Iowa hibernate, we think, it's actually super poorly known, but some of them appear to hibernate in some of these just little localized spots like Adam had mentioned. If you have like a rocky face along a creek, there'll be little crevices in the rock that'll go back in there, and they'll hibernate there. And we don't know if the fungus is getting into those kinds of places.
Okay, well, we'll have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about the bats of Iowa. With me, Russ Benedict, professor of biology at Central College in Pella, and Adam Jenke, ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist. We'll also take your calls. 866-780-9100 is the number. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the bats of Iowa. With me, Adam Jenke, assistant professor at Iowa State University. He's also the Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. Russ Benedict is also here. He's a professor of biology at Central College in Pella. His research focuses on the northern long-eared bat, which is listed as a federally threatened species. We'd love to hear from you as well. Questions about bats, your observations, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Russ, we were talking earlier about your missed nets. I heard that you had a pretty good night last night. Tell me about it.
Yeah, no, we have three teams that we deployed across Worth County, which is up here on the Minnesota line. So I'm working with Carly Kalena from Barker Lamar Engineering, and also Daryl Howell from Iowa DNR. And so we split up into three sites, and I think between the three sites we ended up with about 45 bats, and I think how many species. We had four species. So we had eastern red bats, which we haven't actually seen much of this year, which I'm a little bit worried about. Lots of big brown bats, lots of little brown bats, and then we did get three of our northern long-eared bats and kind of squeezed that in between thunderstorms during setup and then thunderstorms that greeted us as we were leaving the site at 2 a.m. So it was an exciting night.
Wow. Well, and thank you for getting up early to talk to us this morning. Are you tracking all of those different species? I know your research is focusing on the northern long-eared bat, but I mean, you're gathering data on all the different species of bats you collect?
Absolutely. That's one of the I think absolutely amazing things about bats is they're so poorly known. Here we are in the U.S., one of the best studied places on earth, but simple things like what is the geographic distribution of the northern long-eared bat here in the Midwest? We have a broad picture for that, but we don't know the details. And so there's a whole bunch of the details of bat biology that we don't know. So even though we're focusing this work on northern long-eared, we are, in fact, taking as much data as we can from all those other species. So simple things like, what time of year do they have their young? What time of year do the babies come out and start flying? What time of year do they leave for hibernation? All of those kinds of pieces of information are extremely poorly known. So we're adding quite a bit of information to that. Even though what we're doing is really pretty low tech, just going out and stringing up some nets and catching bats.
Well, I want to get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Sue is on the line in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks so much. I've lived here about 30 years, and I have always enjoyed twilight and watching my bats come. And this summer, I have none. Is there something I can do to encourage them to come back? Is what any clue what's going on? you know, my neighborhood hasn't changed significantly. We still have the great big huge oak and shagbark hickory trees. Nothing's come down. So, any clues?
All right, that's an observation in a very local area. Adam, do you want to respond to that?
Well, it's hard to say what is going on in any single place, but that if we look to the east, that's a familiar refrain that we've heard since the introduction of white nose syndrome in 2006 in New York. What were once extremely common species, like, for example, the big brown bat and the little brown bat, have seen really remarkable declines in a lot of places, and people notice them. For example, in many eastern populations, the estimates of declines in little brown bats are exceeding 95% in winter hibernacula. And so what I like to tell folks is if, for example, in, say, Ohio, 5 years ago, you saw 10 bats in your backyard every single night, odds are that you'd be lucky to see one bat in your backyard this year. So, of course, what's going on specifically in any one neighborhood, if it's associated with potential declines, we don't know. But as sort of a general generalization from the east, we know that that's something folks are really noticing in their own backyard.
So definitely something to be concerned about, although with the variation from year to year, she could see more bats next year.
Oh, she sure could. Yep. Could be something with the way the winds are blowing or insects or all sorts of things could drive sort of a local factor like that.
Now, I mentioned earlier how bats tend to have a bad reputation, but one of the things that people do love about bats is the fact that they eat, for example, mosquitoes. Can you give me an idea of the impact of bats in an area? How many mosquitoes, how many other insects would they eat in a night, for example?
Yeah, they eat a lot of insects. We know that. Sort of adding to what Russ said is these are relatively understudied species, but some of the studies that we have to point to have been really interesting in agricultural environments, the amount of agricultural pests that bats can eat. For example, a study that was on big brown bats looked at what a colony of 150 big brown bats would eat in a year. And they estimated that they would eat about 600,000 adult cucumber beetles. And anybody involved in agriculture, I think maybe will perk up to hear that, because cucumber beetles are the adult form of corn rootworm. And bats are really efficient foragers on beetles and also on moths. And so we see a lot of consumption of these ag pests where forested areas meet agricultural landscapes and make for really nice foraging habitats. So they can have a big impact on a local insect population when they're around.
All right, so that can be extremely beneficial. They have another very important role that they play in our ecosystem as pollinators too, right?
In some species of bats, it's a very important role. In fact, if anybody likes tequila out there, they can thank a bat, because in the southern regions where we grow the plants that produce tequila, bats are the main pollinator of that plant. Now, in Iowa, all of our bats actually are insectivores. And so we don't have any pollinating bats in Iowa, but other places, bats eat fruits, bats eat are pollinators, or they eat nectar. And then even sort of part of the folklore is that some bats do eat blood or bite organisms, essentially, but not in Iowa,
not
in
humans,
North America.
Right.
Right.
All right. Well, and speaking of that nasty reputation that bats have, Russ, you mentioned that you've been very interested in bats for a long time. How did you get interested in bats? What attracted you to these creatures?
That's a great story, and I can do it quickly too. So I was taking a class at University of Nebraska at Omaha, and we had a field trip that night to go out and catch bats. It was a class on the mammals of Nebraska, and I remember being uninterested. You know, a typical of a college student, I think I wanted to hang out and eat pizza with my friends. I just didn't think it was going to be interesting. But I went out and netted bats that night for 2 hours with that professor, and at the end of that night, I knew it was something I was going to do for the rest of my life, just literally being out there and seeing them once. and kind of seeing the magic of bats flying by you on a creek and their wings flashing in the moonlight, and then handling these things and seeing that, you know, a bat in a house can be scary, but when you're out in their world, they're absolutely amazing. I mean, their anatomy, their biology is so much fun. Their charisma, when you have them right in the hand, is just unbelievable.
But so, the charisma, explain that.
Well, they just have such personalities. They vary. Some of them are really feisty and will bite the heck out of you. But you know, it's just all in that you know, all critters do that. All critters try and protect themselves.
Sure.
So big brown bats are really feisty. But on the other end of that, Indiana bats are super mild mannered. You know, they'll open their teeth and open their mouths and show their teeth and look mean, but you can literally stick your finger in there and they won't bite. So just the personality they show as you're handling them, and again, kind of that mystery. You know, we check our nets every 10 minutes, and just by magic, a bat seems to appear in the net, and then you let them go, and you try and follow them with the light, but poof, just like that, they're gone again. So there's just an element of mystery to the whole thing that's a lot of fun, too.
Yeah. Well, and like Sue in Pleasant Hill, I love to watch them when they appear in the evening, and there's this sort of magic time where the barn swallows kind of disappear, and they make way for the bats, and watching them as they move through the air, and their wing movements are so quick. I mean, tell me a little bit about their wings and how they work, Russ, because I do think they have this fascinating anatomy.
Oh, they do. Yeah, they have incredibly long fingers. So if you imagine taking your fingers and expanding their length by 10 or 20 times, their first finger or their index finger and their middle finger are about 1.5 to 2 times longer than their forearm is, to give you a little bit of a sense for how long they are. So super long fingers, and then this thin sheet of skin that connects all the fingers and then extends all the way down and connects to the feet as well. So it ends up being kind of a kite-like shape. The sheet of skin has bands of muscle in it, so they can control the right wing independent of the left wing, and that'll allow them to steer. It also has blood vessels out in it. You'll occasionally see holes getting poked in it, and they'll heal those up. So you'll quite commonly see bats with you know, small pinhole type scars in their wings. But then their thumb projects up free of the wing and has a little claw on it. So if you've ever watched a bat climb, they'll fold the whole wing up, but then use that little thumb with its claw to climb up a tree.
It's amazing. And that little flap of skin at their tail, do they use that as a rudder?
They use it as a rudder. So it connects, it wraps from one foot, it connects the tail, and then it includes the other foot. So it extends across there. We call it the tail membrane. And it's definitely used as a rudder, definitely used as a brake. But also, probably most importantly in our local bats, that's their baseball glove. That's where they catch most of the insects. So if you can think, if you're trying to find your way through echolocation, you don't want a big June beetle in your mouth.
Right, that would make you blind, right?
Right, exactly. So yeah, they will literally carry larger insects in that tail membrane, go sit in a barn somewhere and chew on it or something along those lines. And I did want to comment real quickly on Sue's comment. One of the things that I think we see is maybe there was a big old house in her neighborhood that had a huge colony of big brown bats, and the people paid somebody to come in and seal up the entrances. Or maybe there was a barn nearby that got knocked down, and that had a whole bunch of bats. So I do think that the disappearance of a local roost like that can sometimes cause people to see dramatic and very sudden changes in bat populations. So it may not necessarily signal anything major in the landscape. It might just be a real localized thing.
Right, and it could be a change that would be hard to notice.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
I want to talk about rabies, because I think that's one of the things that scares people the most about bats. For a lot of people, bats are just synonymous with rabies. Adam, what's the concern there?
Yeah, so bats, just like all mammals, have potential to carry rabies and be a potential exposure pathway to domestic animals and also to humans. And so that's another part of the lore around bats. We hear oftentimes that there's a perception that all bats have rabies. And that, of course, is really far from the truth. Bats are an important rabies vector, and we like to remind people that when handling any mammals, we have to be careful. Of course, we don't get very many opportunities to handle a bat, and so when a bat is sick, there's a temptation because they're so small to pick them up, and that's the likely exposure pathway to come in contact with a rabies positive bat. I downloaded the Iowa Department of Public Health summary on rabies just in anticipation of these types of questions. And in 2016, they tested 503 bats. And so those are bats that people obviously found and had concern or had suspected would be potential rabies positive. And so only 2.4% of those 500 bats they tested were positive. And so we actually would anticipate in the wild populations, those rabies numbers would be considerably lower because we're only testing bats that we suspect could have rabies. So not all bats have rabies, but like all mammals, it's important to exercise caution whenever you're handling something.
And, right. Any wild animal will bite you if
exactly.
you pick it up. So
exactly.
if you have a bat in your house, what do?
You follow basic sort of precautionary steps. You want to try to not come in direct contact with it with, for example, bare hands. If you have to handle it, I'm sure Russ wears leather gloves every night or something to prevent a bite. And a good technique is the old bucket and a broom technique. Just find the bat, shoo it into a bucket or a laundry basket or whatever you have and walk it back outside and let it fly away on its own.
All right. So, and what about just, can you just open up a window and hope they fly out if you turn off the lights?
Sure. Or? Bats are really wise. They know how to find moving air. That's how they found their way into the house in the first place. And so opening up a window is a good technique. So I guess on the bats in the house thing, it's always worthwhile to sort of consult with a health professional too. If you think there's potential that you came in contact with the bat before you saw it, it may be worth getting it tested.
All right. And now bats in your attic is a different problem. That's not just the occasional bat, but some people have bat colonies that settle in into the attic for the summer. I know people who actually don't mind that a bit, but if you do mind it, what do you do about that?
Yeah, bats, as we talked with big brown bats, they sort of perceive our attics to be pretty good habitat. And if they're sealed off from the house, they're certainly not posing an immediate threat to the people living in the house. But we generally want to keep them out of the house if we can. And so what we want to do is in late summer, after the young have been able to fly, we don't want to lock in young. So late summer, this time of year and beyond, we'll find ways to allow the bats out of the house through the holes that they're getting in, but not back in. And so you can search on the internet for one-way doors, and there's all sorts of configurations of heavy fabric or heavy mesh or long tubes that the bats can go down and come out of, but they can't find their way back into the house. Leave that up for a week or so, make sure all the bats have left the hole, and then carry on with getting the holes filled so the bats can't find their way back in.
Now, as research continues on white nose syndrome, it's going to remain a huge threat in the United States and around the world. But if people want to support local bat populations, Adam, is there anything, we only have about 30 seconds left, but is there anything that we can do to make Iowa a more hospitable place for bats?
Sure. Healthy forests are really important. So protecting our forests and promoting urban tree health and protecting forests in rural areas is really important. And specifically, loose bark species of trees can be really important. So oaks and hickories and things like that.
All right. And maybe don't tear down that outbuilding.
Sure. If you can tolerate them, let the bats live in peace. That'd be great.
All right. Adam Janke, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Janke, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. And Russ Benedict, thank you.
You bet. I'm going to go back to bed now.
All right. Sleep well. Russ Benedict is a professor of biology at Central College in Pella. He focuses his research on the northern long-eared bat, a federally threatened species in the United States. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.